This is Cecilia Kacik, former state senator and the host of the Albany Report, and I'm hosting today's show in the WGXC studios in Hudson. And today is Martin Luther King's birthday and holiday, so happy Martin Luther King Day. Today's show, we're going to focus a little bit on what the governor unveiled in his State of the State budget. We're going to call it Unpacking It a Bit. And here in the studio with me, speaking his mind, is David Little from the New York State Rural Schools Association. He will be helping us to unpack the governor's education budget proposals and what they mean specifically for rural and small city school districts. David, welcome to the Albany Report.
Thanks. Appreciate being here.
So, David, I wanted to invite you into the studio today to help me talk about education. So I assume you listened to the State of the State budget proposal from the governor. And typically, you know, we would have the State of the State beginning of January, and then about this time we would have the budget presentation. So you would have a little time to try to get where the governor is setting his agenda, and then you would look at, to see how the budget reflects that. We got that all in one, condensed all in one day this year. So how did it sound to you?
Well, actually, for the first time in 33 years, it didn't sound to me at all because I didn't get a chance to listen to it. I spent years sitting on the floor of the assembly chamber listening to it as a staff member, but he threw me a curve this year because usually his State of the State message is in the first part of the month. The budget presentation is in the latter part of the month. He put it right in the middle when my son happened to be being sworn into the bar on the exact same day at the exact same time in Rochester, so I didn't hear it this year. But I've read it, and I've been through the briefing book, and I know what he's trying to get at in this.
Well, it certainly was a different, I think, take on education this year than it was last year. I remember last year there was a lot of education policy points tied to the budget and kind of a bullying tactic by the governor to kind of push his policy agenda. And I think that the legislators rejected it and the public rejected it quite vehemently. And we have seen him kind of take a few steps back. But in his State of the State, I remember him saying that education was going to get a $2.1 billion increase. And that to me was, wow, that's what the advocates and the close to what the Board of Regents was recommending. But it wasn't until you read the budget document that that 2.1 was over 2 years, period, an increase, not a one-year increase.
Yeah,
so that some of the detail obviously was more left to the budget documents that you had to sift through.
It was an interesting approach, and you're right. In the past couple of years, the governor's taken advantage of his only real opportunity to affect education policy, because in our Constitution, it's not the purview of the governor to run the state education department, unlike virtually every other department. And so putting money in a budget to do specific things toward education is his only real way of entering that arena. And he took full advantage of it in prior years. It was a little surprising this year that he didn't. And at the same time, omitted some of the things that people had found so onerous in prior years. He included the state aid runs, which he didn't do last year.
Last year, right.
He, in essence, said, do these things that I want or else you're not going to get your new state aid increase. And by the way, I'm not even going to tell you what those aid increases are going to be until later on in the process. And he's corrected those things in this. There are no overt threats of education policy or withholding of aid. It's an on-time proposal in plenty of time for the legislature to deliberate. It doesn't throw a bunch of policy in with the language and that type of thing. He doesn't mix money and language, which has always been, it's been the matter of court decisions in the past, whether or not that's permissible. So he stayed away from all the things that could have been contentious. And yet at the same time, as you say, he's provided a little less than half of what our state's own Board of Regents, what in any other state would be called the State Board of Education, the State Board of Regents, the Commissioner, and the Educational Conference Board, which is made up of all of the large statewide education associations. They all agree that just to, as you'd say, roll over last year's what we do for programs and services in the past years, and just to do that again next year would take over $2 billion. Normally, the state would provide about $1.2 billion of that, and we'd be able to raise about $800 million of that locally under the tax cap. This year, there is no tax cap. It's in actuality a tax freeze because it's tied to the rate of inflation, which is zero, and so the amount that you can raise over and above last year's amount locally is zero. And so the state needs to come up with the difference in that, and he hasn't done that in this proposal.
And he didn't even really address that as an issue.
No, the tax cap is his signature proposal. He, you know, claims credit for having restrained taxes that were out of control before as a result of that law. But the tax cap law in New York does some things that no other state had done. It goes far beyond that. Most states have a 2.5% cap, or the municipality has a 2.5% cap, and they pay for public education within that. So if they have the chance to raise public educational revenue, they can cut someplace else and make that decision locally. Ours is specific to education. It's 2% or whatever the consumer rate of inflation is. Schools don't go by the consumer rate of inflation. They don't pay a consumer's cost. Consumers don't pay double-digit increases to the state retirement system for employees. And they don't pay large numbers of people's health insurance, which lately has also been in the double digits. And so very hard for school districts to stay under a consumer's rate of inflation. So when that rate of inflation is zero, obviously it's virtually impossible to do that.
So this 2% tax, I just want to reiterate this because I think this is a really important point, is really zero this year. So school districts cannot, because of the way it's structured, cannot raise local property taxes without getting a supermajority.
One of the things that we've recognized since the tax cap has been in place is that it's statistically very, very difficult to override the cap. It's statistically very, very difficult not to pass a budget if you're under the cap. The public has come to regard the level of the tax cap as the line of demarcation.
Right.
And they'll either support or oppose based on whether you're over or under that. Can't go over it statistically and expect it to pass. And so when it's zero and you can't expect it to pass if you try and pierce the cap, you've put schools back into the position like they were in the Great Recession, of having to cut the programs and services and the people who provide them in order to stay under the cap, despite the fact that you're paying for things like double-digit health care and double-digit retirement system contributions.
Right, the costs go up. Now, it's really fascinating and complicated the way we fund schools in this state. One of the things that I know the Senate Republicans passed legislation on the first day of session saying, we will eliminate the GEA, the gap elimination adjustment. So you have state aid and you have local property taxes. Then you have this GEA portion, gap elimination adjustment. Could you explain how that fits into this equation and why didn't the governor, you know, pay that back?
Well, he's proposed paying it back in 2 years. It's extremely incongruous that we have a gap elimination adjustment, which means that we're going to take money back from what we owe schools. We're going to take that money and we're going to use it to try and pay off the gap in our state budget.
Right. And this came about when we had a huge budget shortfall, and we essentially closed that shortfall back in 2009, 2010, right? And we did it on the backs of education and our local schools. And we said, we're going to take this money out of our school budgets and we'll pay it back maybe later. And so schools are owed this money that they never received. And so there's this negative on their budgets in most school districts still of a significant amount of money that is money owed by the state that we never get. It's just bizarre.
Yeah, and it's not an insignificant amount that's left. It started out being billions, and they have restored some of that money over the past few years. The past 2 years, we've had aid increases that included what they considered to be gap elimination adjustment restoration. there's still about $430 million left to be restored, and the governor has proposed restoring part of that this year and the rest of it next year. It's just extremely odd that years after fixing our own state budget gap, we still have a gap elimination adjustment. We're still taking it from schools, despite the fact that we don't owe it for anything.
And we're not even talking about the CFE lawsuit campaign.
Well, that's interesting timing, too, because way back when all of this happened, the state agreed that it owed schools billions of dollars. They didn't even have to wait to be ordered. This was a court-ordered settlement, and the state was going to pay schools about $5 billion. It started out in the first couple years doing that. Then the recession hit, and it abandoned its effort. First it froze education, and then it started billions and billions in cuts over years. And so now it's ironic because those petitioners, I guess at this point you'd have to call them, have gone back to court mm-hmm. to say, the state has abrogated its responsibility under the Constitution. It's not paying what it was necessary to provide the constitutionally protected education that our kids have. And the courts are just about to rule on that again. We're waiting for a decision on that. So once again, the governor may have come up about $1 billion short in what should have happened right at the same time that the courts are reiterating that you guys are way behind on your payments on this deal, and it's amounting to a constitutional violation. It's interesting, and when I speak to groups, I ask them what their reaction would be if we decided we didn't have the money to have freedom of speech anymore. We didn't have the money to have freedom of religion or freedom to congregate as a group anymore. We can't enforce that because we don't have the money, and yet we're perfectly willing to say we're not going to provide a constitutionally protected right to our children because we're a little short of cash. Well, the irony here is the state's not even short of cash
right.
anymore,
right.
and it's still decided it's not going to do it.
It's frustrating, I'm sure. So do you think the governor is saying on the GEA, we're going to do it in 2 years because he can count on the legislature to demand that it be paid down sooner? So he's kind of – how much of this is political gamesmanship and how much are you – you know, do you think is really where the governor's priorities are? Is
yeah.
that there is a give and take during the budget process and all
that. Sure, because they're on different electoral timelines. The governor, you know, has recently been elected. – Typically what happens in that four-year cycle is, in the very beginning, the governor will make whatever cuts he can to try and recalibrate. You know, I mean, public education is an astronomical expense to the state. He is correct when he says that we pay more on average per child than any other state, and we pay just an astronomical amount, you know, in the 20s of billions of dollars, more than the gross domestic product of about a quarter of the nations on the planet, we pay for public education in one state alone. So it's a big nut to try and build on every year to say we need more and more and more to keep the same thing going. The problem for the legislature is they have to run every 2 years, not every 4 years. So they don't have the luxury of being able to cut back in the first years, say we'll make it up right before we have to get elected again. They have to run. If you're not running this year, you're running next year. And so perhaps the governor is counting on the legislature. I've said to my members, you know, the governor's proposal for state aid is light. But governor's proposals are always light
right.
because they wait for the legislature, who has the political imperative, to add to that amount. If you look back over the last four election cycles, the state Senate has gone from Republican to Democrat to a combination of Republican-Democrat and back to Republican, all largely based on the fact that there are constituents out there who don't believe that whoever they had in office as their representative had gotten them enough in state aid to keep their local property taxes stable, and particularly on Long Island. And so they'll get somebody else. And we've seen this tremendous volatility in the state Senate in particular over that one issue. And so for them to get enough money for state aid for their constituents is absolutely first on their agenda.
So one of the a key battle during this budget cycle will be education funding. How much is added? I think we can assume money will be added because it's inadequate by the legislature, and how it's spent will be the two key education.
Yeah, if I could just jump in for a second. In past years, locally, when we would raise money, those school districts that we count on to raise their own money would do so. The high wealth districts, the suburban districts that have tremendous property wealth, would get a fairly insignificant amount of state aid.
Mm-hmm.
That leaves more of the state aid to be distributed to the low wealth districts that have true need. They can't pay for what's required on their own. They simply don't have the local resources
right.
to do it. And so the state will try. For the last couple of years, about 70% of the state aid has been pushed out to low-wealth districts. This year, because there is a local property tax freeze, those high-wealth districts are as much in competition for that state aid as low-wealth districts are, because they, too, are frozen. They don't have the ability to tax themselves this year.
So they will be forced to cut if they don't get more state aid.
They will, and that will be politically disadvantageous for those legislators who will be running in the midst of cuts, despite the fact that the state is in good economic shape. It'll be extremely apparent to voters that the state has the money, but these legislators and the governor have collectively determined that we're not going to send it to school districts, despite the fact that we've got it, and that's going to be problematic for them running.
If you were a legislator and you've worked around the legislature for many years and you've worked around Albany, if you were a legislator, what would you recommend to fix this conundrum? We don't want schools fighting, against each other, because the schools with more money and resources are going to win. They also probably have more people.
It's a tremendous bullet to bite.
Yeah.
And they've never been willing to do it. But what the state needs, and what would be politically advantageous to them in the long run, assuming they could survive the short run, which is always the concern, but getting a state aid formula that is legitimate and in law and accurately reflects what a community can legitimately pay for its own, and have the state make up the difference, takes it out of the hands of the legislators. Right now they have this expectation on the part of their constituents that despite all of the rules, they'll somehow get in there and fight and bring back more money than the formula would create so that we can go on doing the things that we expect to
yeah.
do. And every single legislator has that expectation. So, we create this disharmony in the legislative process by making them fight over something that should be a matter of course. It should be, this is what the property value is worth in a district. This is what the people make in the district from an income perspective. That puts them at this level. That generates this much state aid, and we go on with life. Instead of having this annual kind of free-for-all over whatever funding is available.
So so that would be, in the perfect world, that should happen, but it's not likely to happen anytime soon. But at least we can identify that these things should happen. So what's going to happen this year? So the battle will be between, if we get more money into the education budget, what's going to the GEA versus the foundation formula, right? So
it's a very complicated circumstance. The GEA restoration itself has something like 17 steps. The foundation aid formula has been, in subsequent years, frozen, cut, and ignored.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're trying to do both things at the same time, it gets very political, because you can adjust both of those formulas to get the result. And I shared secretarial staff when I was in a council in the state legislature with the person who was doing education aid, and sat there many nights while he worked the formula backwards.
Hmm.
Senator so-and-so needs this much money, so how do we fill in the blanks? Not working the formula forward to see what the formula generates, but knowing what we need to come up with at the end and changing the formula backwards to make sure you got to that amount. So that's how we do it. The regents have proposed.
That's called tricky math.
Yeah. It's interesting that the regents have proposed synthesizing providing operating aid to school districts and GEA restoration, because originally the governor cut money from the GEA out of operating aid, out of foundation aid, and he took it, like John Dillinger used to take it from the banks because that's where the money was, he took it from the districts that needed it the most because that's who got the operating aid. That's who got
the
foundation aid.
Because those are the ones that had the most state aid, because those are the ones that couldn't rely on local property taxes.
Yeah, exactly. So they got hit the worst.
The GEA exacerbated the funding position of small city and rural schools, especially. I remember when I was on the school board there when these cuts were taking place. It was devastating.
We took the most money in a crisis from the people who needed it the most.
Yeah.
And so when we started to restore it, he tried to restore it there first. So now there's a combination of restoring. When you restore everything that's left to be restored, you have to restore percentage-wise more to high-wealth districts. You're giving back the money to the people who need it the least now. Mm. Now, in the process, you're also giving back what you owe to the people who needed it the most. And by coincidence, because of the tax cap, the high-wealth districts also need money this year because they can't raise it locally. So it might actually work out that it helps them to do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But for many years now, the regents have suggested combining the two. You know, you've only got one pot of money, and no district really cares what label it comes under. Just get it in my door,
right,
so that I can use it. And so the regents have said, let's take part of the GEA and part of the foundation formula and kind of squeeze them together and send it all out according to district's wealth. And that makes a great deal of sense, except that our foundation formula has never been fixed. In the foundation formula today, as we speak, you can actually be, a school district can be twice as poor as the state will recognize. And so they will end up getting half of the money that they need, on top of the fact that those are the districts that can raise the least themselves. And so very much in New York State, despite the fact that we're fond of saying we pay more on average per child than any place else, it's absolutely determined by where you live and what district you happen to be in. We pay more than anybody else because we have some school districts that pay an astronomical amount for public education for their kids. And then we have some kids who remain needy. And we have some districts that haven't graduated half of their kids in a generation. So to say that we have no need because we pay a lot on average is the classic example of one foot in boiling water and one foot in ice water, so on average you're okay.
Right, and it's the old adage, if you don't agree there's a problem, we can't come up with a solution. You know, so if we're not agreeing that the problem is not so much the total amount but the disparity in funding, and you really have to even out the funding, and that would lower local property taxes more than anything else. But we don't have those conversations because we're not talking about these issues.
It's very politically difficult to try and address the problem systemically, because in New York State, we never get rid of anything. We just add more on top of it.
Who's in charge of the foundation formula? We have the Board of Regents. We have the governor. We have the legislature. And the Board of Regents should be the ones that make changes to the foundation formula, or it would seem to me.
You know, in our state, we have a classic example of checks and balances. You know, our Constitution, we decided that we didn't want public education to be under the governor's authority, like every other state agency is, so we put them outside of it, and yet he's got the authority to determine their budget and that type of thing. So he's not making policy, usually, but he is trying to pressure them. So every year the regents make their own proposal for what should be the state aid proposal, and every year in some degree the legislature ignores it and does what they feel they need to do, as opposed to what the regents would do from a policy perspective, kind of sitting back and looking, here's what our system needs. The legislature has to say, yeah, but these folks need this and those folks need that, and we have to cobble this together in kind of a puzzle rather than working a system.
So what would help school districts in the WGXC listening area more? Complete elimination of the GEA or foundation funding, if that's one of the battles that's going to occur. How do we figure out what helps our local school districts so we can participate in this discussion?
Yeah, the school districts here truly do need a synthesis of both of those things, because some of them have a great deal of the GEA left to be restored, and all districts want that amount gone. And we can't really talk about how we create a new and appropriate and accurate funding formula until it is gone, because it's not supposed to exist. It was never intended to be part of the process. And so we've got to eliminate that first before we can really move on. But you have districts with tremendous need in your listening area, and so you have districts that are very dependent upon operating aid. And because of this crisis that we've created ourselves by saying that localities are not allowed to raise any money this year, all districts are in tremendous need of foundation formula, because the governor is saying everybody's going to get a 2% increase in their state aid. Well, okay, except we usually count on at least a 2% increase in state aid. Last year and the year before that, it was closer to 6% right. and 5%. So it's a cut in itself, but it's compounded by the fact that we usually get to add 2% of local revenue on top of the 2% or 4 or 6% of state aid. And now he's saying it's 2%, period. And we have contracts that are probably at 2% already that we can't change. We have our medical expenses that are in the 7% range today as we speak. And we've got a 13% retirement system contribution for all of our employees. And so there's no way in the world with a 2% state aid increase to do anything except get rid of programs and services and the people that provide them.
Yeah, so this is going to be a tough year for schools, despite the glossy rhetoric of $2.1 billion in an increase. And, you know, as we said, the devil's in the details. It's really over 1 year, and it's really not enough to deal with the reality that the schools are facing.
Yeah, well, and the irony is, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but the irony is that the state has a surplus, and then the state also has $2.3 billion left from the banking fine settlement money. And nobody is suggesting that we add that into the base. That's a one-time shot.
Right.
But there are lots of one-time shots for public education that are required. Last year, the governor decided to give $125 million in prior year aid claims to private and parochial schools. Well, public schools are owed about $220 million in prior year aid claims, and he's proposed giving them $18 million of that this year.
He also proposed he made mention of his universal pre-K, and I can't quite remember what his stand on that was. Is he adding money for universal pre-K? And let's be clear, we don't have universal pre-K upstate, the rest of the state. This really started out being an issue that Mayor de Blasio in New York City raised as a priority, and the mayor wanted to fund it with local tax revenue. And the governor said, no, the state will come in and fund it, and we'll have universal pre-K statewide. But the upstate portion only came out to be, like, what, $30 million? It's clearly not enough to create universal pre-K upstate. So what's going on with that in this year's budget?
We're in our third year of trying to make a serious run at actually having pre-K for all kids. The first year was $100 million for New York City, because exactly for the reasons you state. New York City said, we're going to do it on our own, and the governor really wanted to keep control of it, and he said, no, I'll pay for it. So he gave the city $100 million. Upstate got nothing. The second year, Upstate got $30 million so that he could claim that this really was a universal program. The problem, of course, was that $30 million spread across 700 school districts that don't have the space to provide universal pre-K, and the state so far has not evidenced any intention of being able to pay for transporting those three-year-olds to and from school. In fact, it penalizes school districts for doing it. You get state aid for every mile that you drive for approved programs and services. If you're taking your kids to school for the main instructional program for the main part of the day, you get state aid on that. if you decide that you're going to take those buses and do something else with it, they detract all of those miles from your state aid. So if you want to go out without the state aid being authorized for it and transport your three-year-olds to school every day and take them home every day, you're actually going to get less state aid, not just neutral state aid on that. You get less because of that.
Wow.
And the state hasn't decided that it's going to pay for that.
Well, that, of course, you know, harms rural school districts where transportation is huge.
Yeah, if we can't get the kids to and from anything, we can't do it.
Right. And also, wasn't Upstate required to be reimbursed for the funds? It wasn't. You weren't given the money up front. You had to pay for it and then get reimbursed.
Which is one of the other things that we really could have used this infusion of the banking money for, because that's a one-year process to say, rather than wait to have local taxpayers pay for this and then the state to give you the money after the fact, we could turn that around and say the state is going to pay for it first and then roll that over to pay for it each year.
Well, I have to just say it's clever contracting management, because if you make it so onerous that the school districts can't apply and can't submit an application to get the funding, you can then say they didn't apply, they don't need it, they don't want it, which to me is what was going on. They didn't really want to spend the money.
The state does that in several arenas, makes it really difficult. Rural schools in particular don't have the staff dedicated to apply for grant programs and things like that. And so you're right. They will count on, they'll allocate an amount of money and count on it not being spent, at least in this fiscal year, so that they can move that money into other areas of need.
It's really crazy, I think. You know, you have a need. If you tie it to, as you said earlier, to the need, it is part of your formula, then you have the resources to make it happen, to make these schools go through these somersaults to try to get the funding that we know they need is, you know, only way to make it harder for the money to get out the door.
Between the money changing every year and our approach to public education being so volatile in the past few years, school districts have change fatigue. You know, their circumstances, both what they have to provide and how they're going to pay for it, have changed every year for as long as I can remember. Excuse me.
Well, there's another thing that Governor brought up in his speech was there are failing schools that don't have majority of their students graduating and going on to college and successful careers. They need more support. He proposed, I think, $100 million for community schools and to turn these quote-unquote failing schools, I wish we wouldn't call them failing schools, these schools into community schools so that they have more support for social, emotional well-being of the students. A lot of these schools are in very high poverty areas, and there's a lot going on around the home environment than, you know, what's happening in schools. And, for example, it's very hard to teach children who are hungry. And so at a community school, I would imagine, you're giving the kids breakfast and lunch, and you're not making them go through, you know, forms to determine that they really do deserve to be fed.
Yeah, or children that can't see the board will have the opportunity to have vision screening before that gets to be a real problem. It's actually the perfect topic to talk about today, because I've long said that if my parents' generation's great shame was the segregation of schools, that the way that we fund public education in New York is on us. That's our generation's great shame, because we have the entire Rochester City School District graduates 43% of its kids.
Wow.
You know, and so the fact that if you live here, you'll be fine. If you live there, you don't have any chance whatsoever of success in life. And we know that from the time that you're born, and we don't do anything about it. It's an onerous title to say that they're failing schools, but it's the truth, because they haven't succeeded for my lifetime. And so if my father never graduated and my grandfather never graduated and I don't have any expectation of graduating, then I can understand things like Ferguson, Missouri, or what happened in Baltimore, because that's less about having a police community relationship problem and more about a systemic lack of hope,
right?
Lack of economic hope. And if I don't have any hope in the society that you've structured around me, why in the world would I have any loyalty to it? And so we truly need to figure out what we're going to do about our generation's great shame, which is we have schools that we know will not serve kids, and we've done nothing about them.
I know when I was a senator, I had kids come to me and say, we don't have math books that we can take home to learn math because there's so many kids in our class, we have to share the books. And, I mean, what are we doing to these kids?
We have tremendous innovation these days. Digital learning has been an explosion, and the technology that we can bring to bear to individualize education is phenomenal. The things that can be done now are absolutely phenomenal, and yet we've entrenched ourselves in the way we do business so severely that we haven't been able to address the issues of high poverty. Community schools are a phenomenal idea, as much in rural areas as they are in urban areas, because they share many of the same problems.
I'm glad you said that. I remember going to a meeting of a bunch of school board members in a rural area, and one of the superintendents saying, you know, we have a mental health issue that, you know, we need to deal with around our schools. You know, the schools are where the kids come and the parents come to get them. We should be providing more mental health services, for example, at our schools. And we know we need to be more like a community school and seen that way, because that's where we can be most efficient. And if we're not providing those services around the school, we're going to miss the kids. We're going to miss the families. And we're going to miss the opportunity to help people in need, because they often don't have the ability to go to a mental health facility nearby, for example.
Rural schools and urban areas have virtually the same rates of teen pregnancy, of teen drug use, of teen alcohol use. It's largely for the same reasons, lack of supervision and lack of things to do after the school hours end. And so if you drive through, particularly after the Great Recession, when so much of the upstate economy was decimated, if you go through a truly rural community, the school is the community.
Right. Oh, absolutely. It's
the cultural center, the social center, the educational center, the emergency center. It is all things to all people. And so because we have all of these kids in one place at one time, it makes perfect organizational sense to start to provide, as you say, mental health services themselves, and counseling, after-school programs, all of those things around the building that we have, because it really is tragic. What happened when we had the CFE court case and the state started to put money into public education? The way it did that upstate was to provide it in Excel aid. If you're a school district, you could build without having a local component in it. You don't have to pay for this locally. We'll upgrade your facilities. We'll add to your facilities. And in many areas, we now have upgraded and added to facilities, glorious facilities, with no kids in them and no money to staff them.
So the governor said $100 million for community schools. I think that was a lowball number. I think in reality, you're going to need to spend a lot more to turn these into real community schools. I mean, it's one thing to say, we're going to turn you into a community school. It's another thing to say, and here's how we're going to do that and the resources behind that. But that's a huge step forward, I think, in at least realizing that we need to do more to make sure those kids in those failing schools have a decent chance at being successful.
Coincidentally, on February 3rd, there has been an alliance of groups that came together to study community schools and what's needed to do that. And we'll be releasing that report at the Capitol on February 3rd. And so after February 3rd, you know, with much of the budget process left to go, state leaders will have the opportunity to see a plan that lays out very specifically how you need to implement this in all areas, rural areas, suburban areas, urban areas, and how you should judge whether or not certain services and aspects of it are needed. So once they have that, I would think that investing in that would truly start to talk, start to address the needs that, that we've always said needed to be addressed in our neediest areas.
Great. Well, I think it's going to be a fascinating budget process, and I guess it's important for people to stay tuned, get involved in your local school budget process, because that's how you will find out what's happening with your school district. And, you know, if you know what's happening at your school district, you'll be better prepared to talk to your legislators if you decide to do so. Last year, a lot of discussion was around Common Core. Do you see that as something that the legislature is taking a step back on, and the governor is, and there's this task force that's made recommendations? What's happening with that policy area?
I think what will happen when all of this has played out is that we'll have folks that are setting New York State-specific learning standards that will largely be similar to the Common Core, but will be our own. And once we've gotten that done, then we'll start to sort out how much testing, how much evaluation needs to be to keep that system going, as opposed to a system that was intended to be run nationwide.
Super. So you're with the New York State Rural Schools Association. If someone wants to get in touch with you or find out more about the association's work, how do they do that?
Well, you can either give me a call at 518-888-4598, or simply Google us, the Rural Schools Association of New York State. We're affiliated with Cornell University, and we have a research component, and then we also have this responsibility both to educate our members about the implications of state policies and proposed state policies, and to educate the legislature about how their proposals and policies will affect our rural communities.
That's awesome. David Little, I had a wonderful time talking to you about education. It's one of my favorite topics, and I hope we'll have you on again later in the budget session, and you can help us parse what happened with education this year.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with me.